of the day, Smith versus Hope Schools. Mr. Baker.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Hardy. My name is John Baker, and I represent the appellant, Tandem Smith. We are here today on a fairly narrow issue. My client maintains that her rights, both her substantive rights, were violated under the terms of the FMLA. The issue before the court, however, is a fairly narrow one, or at least the primary issue before the court is, and that is a fairly obscure regulation of the United States Department of Labor that talks about an employee fraudulently obtaining FMLA leave. Now, I think that a brief recitation of the relevant facts is somewhat helpful. In this case, Tandem Smith worked at the Hope School. The Hope School is a school in Springfield, Illinois, for developmentally disabled children, youth. She had been involved in two separate incidents where she had been significantly injured and traumatized by students at the school. There were disputes between her and the workers' compensation unit at the school about what restrictions she had. Ultimately, her physicians said she could work provided she was not around any of the students. Ultimately, she was placed into a position, and there is a dispute of fact on this, but Tandem Smith testifies, and I think at this stage we have to credit her testimony, that she was forced to be around students. On August the 25th, Tandem Smith called the morning of August the 25th. She called the workers' compensation unit and told them, "I can't do this anymore. This is too upsetting to me. When you get a position, as per my doctor's instructions, where I'm not around students, please let me know." That was a Friday. The following Monday, Tandem Smith went to the Hope School and she met with Jennifer Klein, who was a human resources officer who was in charge of FMLA. Ms. Smith testified, and this is, most of it's undisputed. There are some disputes about what happened during that meeting. But Ms. Smith testified that she needed to go on a leave of absence. She couldn't do this anymore, and that she had a chronic medical condition. Somehow, the topic of FMLA got brought up during that conversation. Ms. Smith was given the FMLA paperwork. It's the standard United States Department of Labor form for her physician to fill out. Ms. Smith testifies that she was told at that time, you are considered to be on leave. Now, that's a disputed fact, but again, I think at this point we have to credit Ms. Smith's testimony. Now, that was Monday, August 28th. Ms. Smith went to her physician, a Dr. Kara Vasconcells, and went to her office and dropped off the paperwork, and Dr. Vasconcells completed the form, and Ms. Smith picked it up, and on September the 6th, she faxed it back to the school.
Right, with her addition plus previous depression.
That is correct, Judge Williams.
That's what I want you to get to, that her adding that, and then get into this other statement that she totally filled out, which is a big problem.
I'm sorry?
Which is a big problem for you, the other statement.
The plus previous depression?
The plus previous depression, if that's all we were dealing with, you might be in a better position. But then we have the second document that was totally falsified by
No. The second document is completely unrelated to the FMLA leave request, Judge Williams. The second document had to do with a disability leave document. It has absolutely nothing.
That's the attending physician form for disability claim that was filled out entirely by Smith.
It was partially filled out by Smith. That's correct. But that document itself has nothing to do with the FMLA leave, and that document was never used as either a justification to deny her FMLA leave or a justification for her termination. It was never addressed as either one of those. The issue is, and the sole issue, is her form that was submitted, and it's in the appendix. And I think what we have to focus on is what Dr. Vasconcells stated. Dr. Vasconcells stated that, one, she is presently incapacitated. Dr. Vasconcells also determined that she needed a medical leave of absence. Into that form, Tandem Smith included the words plus previous depression.
Let me just make sure I have the facts straight. That second form was also faxed at the same time to her employer.
It was faxed to the employer.
At the same time.
But again, Judge Williams, I have to argue this strenuously. That form had nothing to do with the FMLA leave request. Also, they have never stated that she was terminated for falsifying that form. That was a completely different form for a completely different purpose. It was faxed at the same time, yes, but it was a completely different form that had nothing to do with the FMLA leave. The only thing that was submitted pursuant to her...
But it has something to do with it, and in that it places your client in a bad light. I mean, one of the things that I think we'd have to look at as to whether this added language plus previous depression was done with any intent to deceive or to defraud. And we have faxed along with this another claim form for workman's compensation, which she blatantly forged.
Well,
and that's where the connection comes in, I think.
Well, I would suggest that if we have to look at what her intent was, you know, that was, I don't think, anything that's ever been argued to this point, number one. Number two, if we have to look at what her subjective intent was and whether she intended to commit a fraud, I think that is largely a question of fact that needed to be resolved by a jury and get all the competing views as to why it is that she submitted that document. You know, the second document... It was done, but before the trial court, it was never raised as really a significant issue, and so you know the record as to that is somewhat incomplete, largely because that second document was never really addressed. And I think what we have to get back to though is the specific language of the regulation, and the specific language of the regulation provides that an employee who fraudulently obtains FMLE from an employer is not protected by FMLA's job restoration or maintenance of health benefits provisions. That's what it provides. Now, taking that, Judge Scott concluded that an employee who alters a certification form without her health care provider's permission is not entitled to FMLA leave, regardless of whether the unaltered form would have been sufficient. That, to me, is an erroneous conclusion.
Now, why is that?
Because the question is fraudulently obtained. She didn't fraudulently... First of all, she never obtained the leave.
Let me rephrase my inquiry. Let's assume in our hypothetical for this discussion that a person is entitled to the FMLA leave.
Okay.
But submits, not saying it's your case, a fraudulent application in an attempt to dress it up or push it over the line in the applicant's mind. But what would have been if no alteration had occurred? Let's not call it a fraud or anything. Had not occurred, would have been entitled to it. Is it your position as a policy matter for the law that that should not be a factor as long as the underlying facts justifying the leave?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's my position.
How can that be in line with the regulation?
Okay. Because the regulation says fraudulently obtain, which if we take the definition of fraudulently obtaining, that is obtaining something to which you are otherwise not entitled to receive. Okay? So we have a situation here.
Entitled to a tax return.
A refund?
Refund. Happy instance, but you apply for it under a different name, and it comes to you because of the address.
Well, Judge, I am not familiar with the Internal Revenue Code.
Nor am I. Maybe it's a bad application.
My point is, I don't know what the specific language says, and I guess my point is, the rule means something. And the language of the rule means something. And it says fraudulently obtained. And
I think if it doesn't have a deceiving component, that is, that's the way you would view the fraud. In other words, if it doesn't deceive the employer.
If it doesn't give someone a benefit to which they are not otherwise entitled, That's my view. Because fraudulently obtained, it means that you are receiving something that you are not entitled to receive. And I think,
well, do we want to encourage this kind of practice? Let's say I understand your position, so I'm not arguing with the merits of the leave. But do we want to encourage a practice even where the leave is deserved, where the applicant alters a form? You're saying that's too great a punishment, or
well, what I'm saying is twofold, Judge Flom. First of all, I don't know that we want to encourage it, but the reality is the rule is what the rule is, and the rule says what it says, and it is the Department of Labor who can go back and modify the rule if it thinks that the rule has been abused. And in fact, there have been modifications to the Department of Labor's FMLA regulations. I think it's also important to understand that this FMLA application process is not something that an employee does frequently. I mean, there's no evidence that Tandem Smith had any real knowledge of what was involved with the FMLA. And, you know, she's not a lawyer. She is a layperson. And you know, the doctor says she's entitled to it. She just adds something else to add to her position. And I think to punish her for that and declare, listen, that is fraudulent, I think is wrong, and I think it ignores the language of the Department
just
of Labor's
gilding
rule.
Gilding the lily, so to speak?
I'm sorry?
You're just gilding the lily, so to speak?
She believed that she was under a great deal of stress associated with what she had been through.
Let's assume she genuinely feels that her self-analysis justifies what she altered.
Yes.
But it is a modification of an otherwise an appropriate application.
Correct. I would agree with that.
And how would you cabin the case law, if you were, it was to come out the way you want, that would suggest that this is the exception that's allowed, where it's meritorious, but you have this license to do this. Or, well, I mean, we've got to think beyond the case, obviously.
Right. No, I understand from a public policy standpoint. I think the underlying question is she entitled to the leave, regardless of what she adds in, what language she puts in there. If she is entitled to the leave, and under what the leave statement says, she was entitled to that leave. And so I think that if she's entitled to the leave, she hasn't fraudulently obtained anything, because she's already entitled to it. And I think that is what the rule says.
What if she submitted no application? Would she be entitled to the leave?
Well, if she had submitted no application, no, because the employer requested that she submit medical documentation, and under the FMLA rules promulgated by the Department of Labor, she has to do that within a 15-day period of time. So if she fails to comply with the reasonable request of her employer, then she would not be entitled to the leave.
On the 16th day, would it have the same equities that we have in the case before us?
Well, the rule on that is a little bit clearer. It says the employer must give 15 days. All right. It doesn't. I think at that point you have to look at what is the reason for doing it. You know, if she'd been in a car accident and was comatose for 15 days, and then on the 16th day she submits it, I think that would be okay. If she's simply derelict in her obligations, I think that we have a different question. But there are that rule allows for the equities to be looked at.
May I ask you two quick questions?
Absolutely.
One is, if we adopt your rationale that we should essentially ignore the altered or falsified portion of the certification, wouldn't that give applicants an incentive to add false claims, because they're never punished if they do?
Well,
that can only be helped.
I don't agree with that, because the rule, the FMLA is intended to provide benefits to individuals who have medical conditions. And so the applicants already have that. You have to have a doctor's certification stating that, and you already do. Now, if you have a situation where the doctor doesn't say you're disabled or doesn't say that you need a leave, and you falsify it to say you do, that's a completely different category. So I don't think that we're giving license to people to encourage them to do this. In fact, I think that while I understand the public policy arguments, I don't think most employees are going to review Seventh Circuit case law when they're putting together their
But the certifications don't say you're entitled to or you're not entitled to. That's sometimes they do, but a lot of times the certifications may leave room for interpretation where the employer has to decide whether they're entitled to FMLA leave.
No.
In those situations, the applicant would be encouraged to maybe add something to the form or falsify the form, because there's no harm if they do.
No, I think that's wrong. I don't think an employer can simply make their own determination. What the rules say, if the employer doesn't agree with the determination, they can request that their own physician review it and look at and meet with the individual.
But what was the determination in this case? What was it say, she was entitled to leave or not?
The rationale was that she was presently incapacitated.
But it also says she can do desk job or office job.
If you look at the indication number 3 form on the FMLA form from the Department of Labor, that number 4 is checked, and I don't know that's included in this. Well, actually, it is.
Last portion says she can do an office job or a desk job, and what I'm suggesting is maybe the employer would look at that and say, well, no, she's not entitled to FMLA leave, and that brings up my original point that, you know, it's not so clear-cut sometimes, and therefore applicants might be encouraged to falsify the form in these ambiguous cases.
The problem, that, and I know my time is up. I don't know if
you can conclude with this thought.
Thank you. The problem with that is we have a situation here where we have employees who are not lawyers. They don't understand the law. They don't understand what the requirements are. They're largely told by their employers what they are to do. If an employer doesn't accept the FMLA leave, under the rules, there are things that they can do. They can require that the employee provide them with additional medical information. An employer can require that they submit to an independent medical evaluation. The employer has all sorts of things it can do if it believes that an employee truly is not entitled to leave. They have many, many things available to them to handle that under the rules. And I think that if this situation, that's the way that the rules suggest that it should have been handled with Ms. Smith. I thank the court very much for its patience and indulgence, and I ask that the court reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Hardy.
May it please the court. My name is William Hardy with the law firm of Hinchon Culbertson. I represent the appellee in this case, the Hope School or the Hope Institute. Mr. Baker, Your Honors, there are some factual things that I disagree with that I think are just simply wrong that the plaintiff's counsel has talked about. But I want to get right to all of your questions, because Judge Williams, Judge Flom, Judge Capalla, all of your questions about policy, and Judge Williams, your questions about the other forms that were submitted are very relevant to these policy considerations. We do not want to promote these kinds of alterations. But we're not talking about some innocent little addition to one single form. We're talking about much, much, much more than that. And when Mr. Baker says this disability form had nothing to do with it whatsoever, that's simply not borne out by the record. When Ms. Klein called the Department of Labor, she laid out all of the facts, not just the addition of the previous depression, but also the forged disability form, and there's more than that. Actually, there's considerably more than that. When you look at these forms, she backdates them. She went in and talked to Ms. Klein on August the 28th of 2006. She didn't call on August the 25th, as Mr. Baker has indicated. As we point out in our brief, that statement is not supported by our own deposition testimony. Her own deposition testimony was that conversation with Dolores Showalter happened on August the 22nd. Okay? Now, on September 6th, when these forms were faxed, here's what we have. We have a diagnosis of prior depression, which plaintiff admits she has never been diagnosed with depression. Dr. Vasconcelles testifies she has never been diagnosed with depression. She backdates not only the application for leave to August the 25th and signs that, but she backdates the certification form where she signs it at the end. There is a place for the employee to sign it. The employee signs it August the 25th. There's no question that that is not when she requested it. She went in on August 28th. But the disability form, she signed Dr. Vasconcelli's name to that. This is entitled attending physician form. She faxes this along with all these documents. Now, the employer never got to the issue that you're talking about, Judge Capalla, whether or not this was sufficient. You're absolutely correct that there is a section that says she can do desk work. And there's a question, I think, as to whether or not, whether she could have worked. They never got to that issue because when they saw all of these forms, they said, well, this isn't right. This doesn't appear to be right. They then discovered that those forms were altered, that the disability form was outright forged. They contacted the Department of Labor. Department of Labor said, you can deny FMLA leave. That's what they did. Now, as a policy matter, I don't know how this allowing these kinds of alterations and falsifications could possibly promote the interests of the FMLA. If anything, what such a ruling would do would be exactly what the judges, what your honors are talking about, encouraging someone to falsify forms like this. And, you know, this is not, as I say, some innocent little misrepresentation. And the notion that we never considered all of these things, we laid out the facts in some detail about what happened, and it had to do with more than just this addition of previous depression. With respect to the regulation itself.
But before we get to that,
certainly.
You're advocating a rule that says as soon as an employee alters a form, that gives the employer the basis to deny the leave. That's the rule you'd like to see pronounced in this case, correct or incorrect?
Well, that's what the judge indicated, Judge Scott, in her well-reasoned decision.
All right. Well,
and of course, there are always facts. I mean, you know, you have to decide every case based on the facts presented. And I suppose you could come up with hypotheticals involving different facts. But, I mean, here I would say this, Judge. When you have a form that is altered to include a diagnosis that the plaintiff does not suffer from, that she knows she does not suffer from, and she's altering a form that is supposed to be prepared by the physician, and then she also backdates that form, backdates another form, and then submits a completely forged disability application, I think under those facts, absolutely.
Why?
That kind of an alteration.
Why under those facts? Why under those facts was the employer entitled to deny the leave?
Well, I mean...
Because there was some deception or some fraud or some...
I think there are actually 2 points. Number one, I think it is fraud. I think that under these facts, it's undeniable that she intentionally misrepresented her condition to her employer. And with the intent to deceive. I don't think there's any other result.
Okay, here's my point then. You acknowledge that there could be some situations where an employee just makes some innocent corrections to the form that wouldn't make any difference, correct a misspelling, correct a date, maybe add some information. And there may be situations where the employee is actually trying to deceive the employer, trying to do something illegal, trying to do something false, trying to do something dishonest. The problem in this case was the trial court judge just said if there's an alteration, that gives employer the right to deny the leave. But there was no finding as to whether there was any dishonesty or any fraud or any intent to deceive. And the question for us to decide is if there is that requirement for an intent to deceive, how could the judge grant a motion for summary judgment on this? I mean, don't you think that there would be some legitimate issue of, or genuine issue of fact here?
No, Your Honor.
That's a lot to throw at you, but
right.
Help me if you can.
Well, it is a lot to throw at me, but I would say this about the regulation. Okay, your question, I think, goes to the regulation and his argument that, look, there's got to be some finding of fraud here. I mean, here he claims that the application in and of itself would have been sufficient, you know, if the alteration had not been made. Now, you know, the employer never got to that point. But the regulation we're talking about, that regulation is cited in some of these cases, but it's not the only relevant consideration. And the regulation itself, an employee who fraudulently obtains FMLA leave from an employer is not protected by FMLA's job restoration or maintenance of health benefits provisions. We're mixing issues here, I think, Your Honors. Besides the fact that I think that this was fraud, the reason that we denied leave was because of the alterations, because of the falsifications. The substantive claim that she has here is that we improperly denied leave, not the retaliation claim is basically we retaliated against her, we shouldn't have discharged her, we shouldn't have disciplined her, and those types of things. That really gets at what the regulation's talking about, job restoration, maintenance of health benefits provisions. Here we're talking about the denial of leave itself. That's the substantive claim. And I think that, you know, as a matter of policy under these facts, the only conclusion can be, and by the way, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, about the judge not actually taking that next step. But the facts are undisputed on that. I mean, I don't think any reasonable jury could conclude that she had any intent other than to deceive. She had every opportunity to explain this. She never explained it. She admitted that it was that she never suffered from depression. And there's no question that she backdated the form. There's no question that she filled out the disability form and signed Dr. Vasconcelli's name. So, I mean, it's not just this regulation. The regulation is not the only relevant consideration here. I mean, we're talking about a matter of policy. There isn't very much case law on this, I must say. I mean, most of the cases are district court decisions. And, you know, if you were to give me hypotheticals about someone just innocently adding something to a form, you know, I could see you questioning Judge Scott's conclusion here. But that's not what happened here. That is not what happened.
But isn't there still a question as to whether that's what happened here? I mean, this note, plus previously depression, doesn't look at all like the doctor's handwriting. And as she states in her deposition, he says it stands out like a sore thumb. I don't see how people could look at this and say, well, you know, that's what the doctor's saying. It looks like somebody else wrote that in. And what Ms. Smith is saying is that I just wanted to let them know something. I wanted to give them the full picture. I was just adding something. I wasn't trying to deceive. I wasn't trying to defraud. And again, the problem is that that's still a question of fact. That's still open to debate, I think.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I disagree with you. First of all, I don't think the record reflects that. She never tries to explain this in her deposition or in her affidavit. She never tries to explain why she backdated the form to 3 days before.
Well, but in her deposition, I'm reading from the deposition, she says, I was just trying to be thorough. I was not trying to alter. I was trying. My handwriting stands out like a sore thumb, you know. She says, I knew I was depressed. I wrote it on the history form.
Well, it's a diagnosis of depression, but the backdating, she never disputed that, and the form, the disability form, which she outright forged, there's no explanation whatsoever for that. I mean, if this court concludes that there has to be an actual trial on the issue of fraud, first of all, I don't think that is the intent of this regulation at all. But it also, I think, puts an employer in an impossible position. I mean, the employer in this case got these forms, and what did they do? They immediately called the Department of Labor and said, look, and accurately described what they received. And they were told, look, the person's not entitled to FMLA leave. Now, that is undisputed in the record. And you know, a couple of points that I want to get to about the facts that the plaintiff is talking about. Again, the August 25th date. That's not accurate at all. I mean, what happened here? And I think it's very important that the court understand that this period of time, this August 22nd through September 11th period of time, most of the facts are undisputed. I mean, what happened on August the 22nd was, or the 23rd, if the plaintiff says the 22nd, the Dee Showalter says the 23rd, but plaintiff reported having a single contact with a resident, Tia, okay? Her own testimony was that she reported that contact, and then she told, this is on August 22nd, she told Dee Showalter, quote, "When you find me a safe work environment, call me." Okay? Now, the next thing that happened, and Dee Showalter doesn't dispute that. She says, basically, plaintiff told her that the dietary department was not safe and she was not returning to work until reassigned. Now, you look at the plaintiff's deposition in this case. This is on SA 43, the plaintiff's own supplemental appendix, page 51. She makes it clear she only worked in the dietary department for 1 hour. This was for a one-hour period. Now, the next thing that happens, Dee Showalter says that she, under oath, overnighted a letter to the plaintiff on August the 23rd, which is in our brief on page 7, so I won't read it to you. Plaintiff says, well, that's the first time I saw that letter when I appeared for my deposition. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. She appeared on August the 25th. That letter instructed her to come back to work on August 25th. She had already testified that she never, that she told them, you call me and tell me when to come back when there's a safe work environment. So she wasn't coming back. She then clocks in on August the 25th. She clocks in. There's no dispute about that. She doesn't tell her supervisor, and then she leaves. Okay? So I don't even think a reasonable jury could conclude that she didn't receive that letter. It doesn't make any sense. The next thing is August 28th. That's when she goes in and talks to Jennifer Klein. Okay? Now, Mr. Baker submits that Ms. Klein somehow indicated that her leave was approved. Her testimony, the plaintiff's testimony, is all over the place on that. But when you look at the forms, it's very clear that the forms contemplate that she returned those forms. Okay? I mean, that. So on August 28th, that's what happens. The next thing that happens on August 3rd is the plaintiff admits receiving the letter from Melissa Thompson. And then September 6th, we have no request for FMLA leave at that point. At that point, they start disciplinary proceedings. Now, these documents that they received were received that evening by fax. That fax date is on there. The fax time is on there. They were received after they started disciplinary action. And it's that at that point when they notice not just this previous depression, Your Honor, but the falsified, completely forged attending physician's statement. And I don't know how we can just separate these things out. Mr. Baker says, I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You can conclude that thought.
Mr. Baker says it's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. All of this was submitted at the same time. As a matter of policy, Your Honors, the judge's decision is absolutely correct, and we would ask that this court affirm Judge Scott's summary judgment in favor of Hope School. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy. Ms. Baker, your time had expired, but you may have another minute.
Thank you very much, Judge Flom. I do appreciate that. The issues on appeal now have shifted away from what the issues were before the district court on summary judgment. All of a sudden, we have this issue. Well, is it a question of fact? Mr. Hardy seems to acknowledge that in some respects it might be a question of fact as to whether my client committed fraud, or in general under the rule that he proposes. But he says, as a matter of law, that's the only conclusion that can be reached before this court. Well, I read through it quickly while I was sitting over there. I don't think Judge Scott's decision even references the other document, the disability leave document. And that was never addressed as an issue as to why she was terminated. And so now we're saying, well, that's clear evidence of fraud. And I don't think that that is fair. because it wasn't something. It wasn't an argument that was advanced, and now we're saying, hey, look, this is clear evidence of fraud. So I do think that there is a question of fact as to that particular issue. I would also like to conclude by saying that, well, I do see my time is up, and I appreciate it. This issue is very, very important because Tana Smith was not trying to deceive. The date of August 25th, that was the date she thought that it was her leave was supposed to start because that's the day she went out. There are disputes of fact, so I would encourage the court, if there are questions, to thoroughly review the record. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Just one question. If Hope School denied the FMLA leave because the certification was altered, couldn't Mrs. Smith just merely have submitted another form and asked for FMLA leave?
Well, she could have, except she was fired. She was fired because she missed 3 days of work.
If she wasn't fired, could she have filed another form?
If she had not been fired, if they had said to her, listen, you are allowed to return to work, then I believe that, yes, she could have done that. But in this case, she was fired because she missed the days of work after she had requested it. She was fired for missing the 25th, 28th, and 29th.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thank you, Mr. Hardy. The case is taken under advisement.